Thank you, Brother Lee. Once again, brethren, it's my privilege to introduce to you Brother Nathan Austin. And of course, as many of you know, Nathan's no stranger to us, as he was born and raised in this class. And, you know, he's now with the brethren up in Portland, and they have his assets up there. And so we now have him serving us, and we're so happy that he could join us today. Brother Nathan's talk is titled, The Underdog. The Underdog, Brother Nathan.
Thank you, Brother Russ. First of all, I'd like to thank the Davises, Brother Mark, Sister Alicia, and the boys for being such wonderful hosts, as well as Sister Nanette, who was totally willing if circumstances would have been different. And I'd like to bring love from Jamie and the boys. They would have loved to have been here, and also from the entire Portland class. It's nice to be back. And so our thoughts today, as we said, center on the underdog. And I have sort of a brief lead-up question, which is, do you ever get that feeling that you're working against such a tough road? You know, you're the little guy and you're fighting against all these things. And so that was sort of the focus on where we thought we'd go today. So I'd like to begin by telling you the story of Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn grew up in a suburb of Cleveland in northeast Ohio. His family was in the electrical contracting business. This was in the 70s, at a time before dyslexia was routinely diagnosed. He was held back a year in elementary school because he couldn't read. But he said, I didn't do any better the second time than I did the first time. He had a discipline problem. I sort of got expelled from elementary school, he explained. I think when you hit the teacher, you get expelled. It was one of those disruptive incidents. I was being abused. The teacher put me under her desk and rolled her chair in and started kicking me. So I pushed the chair back, hit her in the face, and walked out. I was in the fourth grade. He calls that period in his life the ugly years. His parents didn't know what to do. It was probably the most frustrating part of my life, which is saying a lot. He went on, because it wasn't that I wasn't trying, I was working really, really hard, and no one understood that part of the equation. They literally thought that I was consciously making decisions to be a disruptive kid, to not learn, to hold the class back. You know what it's like, you're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid, and you're in a public school setting, and everyone thinks you're an idiot, so you try to do funny things to try to create some social esteem. You try to get up every morning and say, today is going to be better. But after you do that a couple of years, you realize today is going to be no different than yesterday. And I'm going to have to struggle to get through, and I'm going to have to struggle to survive another day, and we'll see what happens. His parents took him from school to school, trying to find something that worked. All my mother wanted me to do was graduate high school. I think if you'd asked her, she'd have said, the happiest day of my life will be if he graduates high school. Then he can go drive a truck, but at least he'll have a high school degree. On the day he finally did graduate, Cohn's mother was a fountain of tears. I've never seen anyone cry so much in my life, he said. When he was 22, he got a job selling aluminum siding and window frames for U.S. Steel in Cleveland. He had just graduated from American University after a middling academic career. One day, just before Thanksgiving, while visiting the company's sales office on Long Island, he persuaded his manager to give him the day off and ventured down to Wall Street. A few summers earlier, he'd been an intern at a local brokerage firm and had become interested in trading. He headed to the Commodities Exchange, which was part of the old World Trade Center complex. I think I'm going to get a job, he said, but there's nowhere to go. It's all secure. So I go up to the observation deck and watch the guys and think, can I talk to them? Then I walk down to the floor with the security gate and I stand at the security gate like someone's going to let me in. But of course, no one is. And then literally right after the market's closed, I see this pretty well-dressed guy running off the floor yelling to his clerk, I've got to go. I'm running to LaGuardia. I'm late. I'll call you when I get to the airport. So I jump in the elevator and I say, I hear you're going to LaGuardia. He says, yeah. I say, can we share a cab? He says, sure. I think this is awesome. With Friday afternoon traffic, I can spend the next hour in the taxi getting a job. The stranger Cohn had jumped into the cab with happened to be high up at one of Wall Street's big brokerage firms. And just that week, the firm had opened a business buying and selling options. The guy was running the options business but did not know what an option was. He was laughing at the sheer audacity of it all. I lied to him all the way to the airport. When he said, do you know what an option is? I said, of course I do. I know everything. I can do anything for you. Basically, by the time we got out of the taxi, I had his number, and he said, call me Monday. So I called him Monday, flew back to New York Tuesday or Wednesday, had an interview, and started working the next Monday. In that period of time, I read Macmillan's Options as a Strategic Investment book. It's like the Bible of options trading. Now, this wasn't easy, of course, because Cohn estimates that on a good day, it takes him 6 hours to read 22 pages. He buried himself in the book, working his way through one word at a time, repeating sentences until he was sure he understood them. When he started at work, he was ready. I literally stood behind him and said, buy those, sell those, sell those. I never owned up to him what I did, or maybe he figured it out, but he didn't care. I made him tons of money. Cohn isn't ashamed of his beginnings on Wall Street, but it would be a mistake at the same time to say that he's proud of them. He's smart enough to know that a story about bluffing your way into your first job is not altogether flattering. He told it instead in the spirit of honesty. It was, this is who I am. Cohn was required in that taxi ride to play a role, to pretend to be an experienced options trader when in fact he was not. Most of us would have foundered in that situation. We aren't used to playing someone other than ourselves, but Cohn had been playing someone other than himself since elementary school. You know what it's like. You're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid in your public school setting, and everyone thinks you're an idiot, so you try to do funny things to create social esteem. Better to play the clown than to be thought of as an idiot. And if you've been pretending to be someone else your whole life, how hard is it to bluff your way through a 1 hour cab ride to LaGuardia? More important, most of us would never have jumped in that cab because we would have worried about the potential social consequences. The Wall Street guy could have seen right through us and told everyone else on Wall Street there's a kid out there posing as an options trader. Where would we be then? We could get tossed out of the cab. We could go home and realize that options trading is over our heads completely. We could show up on Monday morning and make fools out of ourselves. We could get found out a week or a month later and get fired. Jumping in the cab was a disagreeable act, and most of us are inclined to be agreeable. But Cohn, he was selling aluminum siding. His mother thought he'd be lucky to end up a truck driver. He'd been kicked out of schools and dismissed as an idiot. And even as an adult, it took him 6 hours to read 22 pages because he had to work his way word by word to make sure he understood what he was reading. He had nothing to lose. My upbringing allowed me to be comfortable with failure, he said. The one trait in a lot of dyslexic people I know is that by the time we got out of college, our ability to deal with failure was very highly developed. And so we look at most situations and see much more of the upside than the downside, because we're so accustomed to the downside. It doesn't faze us. I've thought about it many times. I really have, because it defined who I am. I wouldn't be where I am today without my dyslexia. I never would have taken that first chance. In the case of Gary Cohn, it turns out he was a really good trader. And it turns out that learning how to deal with the possibility of failure is really good preparation for a career in the business world. Today, he's the president of Goldman Sachs. To be clear, that entire story was quoted very nearly verbatim from a book entitled David and Goliath. You may have seen it. David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants by Malcolm Gladwell. If you've never read it, really, really good book. But does that story sound like a movie? It could easily be one. I can see it. What is it about that story, do you think, that makes it so compelling? I wonder if you would all agree that we all seem to really enjoy rooting for the underdog. it just seems to be ingrained in our psyche. In fact, did you know that a surprisingly large percentage of entrepreneurs are in fact dyslexic? A study by City University of London puts the number as high as one-third. Some prominent examples you may have heard of include Richard Branson of Virgin Records and Virgin Atlantic Airways, Charles Schwab of the investment firm, Craig McCaw, who was an early cell phone businessman, David Neilman, I didn't know his name, but he's the founder of JetBlue, John Chambers is the CEO of Cisco, Paul Orfalea is the founder of Kinko's. Those are just a few. So it's interesting what this disadvantage has done for some people. Now, when you think of the Bible, can you think of any examples of underdog stories? Go ahead and make a quick mental list. A brief list that I made would include David and Goliath, obviously, but also Joseph, Esther, Gideon. And if you have any additional suggestions, I'd love to hear your ideas afterwards. So, brethren, the reason we're directing your attention here today is to explore our role as underdogs in this present evil age and how that might be a source of encouragement to us. For it's a blessing and a benefit that can reap for us far greater rewards in the age to come. Over the next part of an hour, we'll look at David's willingness to fight Goliath, Gideon's willingness to lead 300 men against an army of hundreds of thousands, Joseph's patience and faith through his early life, even when enslaved and imprisoned, and how each of these examples can teach us the value of learning the lessons of an underdog. One of the reasons these stories are there for us is that we need to recognize our inadequacies and our reliance on our Father for guidance, for strength, for insight. David not only was a great example of extreme faith, he also exemplified the depth of human failing and fleshly weakness. And we would suggest that he also possessed the ability to forgive himself for his failings and to not withdraw from God when he recognized them. I don't know if you struggle as I do, but I know that I have at times felt so very unworthy, it feels hypocritical to even pray to God for forgiveness. And if my trivial little sins can bring me so low, how would I feel if I had sent a man to his death solely to hide my guilt and my transgressions? The story of Gideon carries within it a warning about the weakness of faith, or about weakness of faith and questioning God. God has the matter in hand always, well before we even have a clue just what his plan might be. And the story of Joseph has so many lessons. For example, even in a situation where you cannot see God, he's certainly working through and with us. We can see in the story an entreaty to maintain your faith and to continue to look for ways in which we might be of service. We can see a reminder to not doubt, to not question God's path for us, to not give up hope, but rather to live with the hand we are dealt and to wait upon the Lord's leading. Consider a very young David shepherding in the fields. What lessons did he learn from watching his sheep? We don't have much experience with the herding of sheep these days, but we know sheep are pretty calm and docile. We might imagine that the biggest challenge a shepherd would face would be just keeping the sheep together and out of trouble. But we learn from David in 1 Samuel, there are larger things to worry about. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 34 and 35. 1 Samuel 17, 34 and 35. David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him, and rescued it from his mouth, and when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." Can you imagine facing a lion or a bear by yourself out in the fields? There's no armor. There's no gun. Only your hands, your feet, maybe a club and a sling. I would be up the nearest tree the minute I heard the sound of a bear or a lion. And yet David, presumably younger than 20 years old at this time, went after them, struck them, and killed them in order to rescue his sheep. I mean, I like sheep, but I'm not sure that would be motivating to me. I recall once hiking up in the Sierras in California, probably with Brother Bob Wilson, and as I rounded a bend in the path, I saw a large bull standing maybe 40 yards away, just looking at me. He didn't seem agitated or angry, but I was still completely on edge. Bulls are huge. There's something about being behind a fence that makes them seem smaller. And he was not behind a fence. And even though we don't think of them as attack animals, they could do a lot of damage to us very easily. I was absolutely afraid he would charge me, and I had to force myself to calmly keep walking down the path and around another bend. And if a bull made me feel like that, I can only imagine that a lion or a bear would be much, much worse. So what lesson does David learn from these experiences? I think from a young age, he knew that God was with him. He relied on him and had no fear because of his faith in God. And faith and confidence have a way of breeding success. David was well aware that God was working with him and watching over him, and he walked daily in that faith. So when it was tested, he reacted without hesitation. Let's read the full passage. This is still 1 Samuel 17, but now it's verses 32 to 37. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine," speaking of Goliath. Then Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Put another way, David had learned that when faced with a much larger, stronger foe, God was the answer. Unlike all those fighting men who relied on their physical, human skill, David had learned to look past the immediate intimidation and the expectations of failure. He had years of practice being the little guy, and they prepared him for that encounter in a way that nobody else could understand. You see, underdogs don't succeed by fighting the battles they've been given. They succeed by changing the rules. A dyslexic person does not succeed by transforming themselves into a fast and accurate reader. Instead, they develop other methods for success, like improved study skills, note-taking, listening. They try to minimize the need for reading, and if reading is absolutely necessary, then perhaps they learn to remember better, so they don't have to read it again. And when Goliath came forward, he challenged the Israelites to a one-on-one duel, spear armor and shield against spear armor and shield. This was probably a standard approach to battle at the time. Champion versus champion. In that battle, Goliath had a massive advantage and everyone knew it. So David altered the expectations to his advantage. We see these sorts of approaches scattered throughout the history books. One that springs to mind are the early battles between the American colonies and the British. And the British expected very formal battles, where you lined up and marched forward and took careful aim, and soldiers were massacred by the hundreds. The army that was bigger or better armed or better trained would win. But those annoying colonists wouldn't line up to be shot. They hid in the fields and the woods, and they blended into the forest, unlike those helpful red coats. Their seeming disadvantage of no training and organization turned into an advantage. They were forced to fight outside the box, using their knowledge of the region and the ability to blend into the general population. Incidentally, we've seen similar problems in more recent history. Vietnam, Iraq, you name it. Let's turn to Gideon. Once again, God chose someone who would not be described as a fighting man. The Israelites at that time would have been oppressed by the Midianites and the Amalekites for 7 years. Perhaps Israel wanted to fight back, but they had no trained army and certainly didn't have the numbers they needed to defeat a larger, better trained force. We read in Judges 6 that they would come and destroy the harvest as well as livestock, and they were aptly compared to locusts wreaking havoc across the land. When you think of Gideon, what's the first thing that crosses your mind? Do you think of his defeat of the huge Midianite army? Or do you also think of his uncertainty and questioning of God's will? I've always thought of the story with the fleece as an example of someone who couldn't see, or at least firmly trust God's guidance. And yet I had forgotten that he actually received one more sign that God was dealing with him. And this one kind of just amazes me. Let's read Judges, the 6th chapter, verses 11 to 21. Judges 6, 11 to 21. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress in order to save it from the Midianites. Beating out wheat hidden in the winepress so they won't see it. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." Then Gideon said to him, "O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord looked at him and said, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" He said to him, "O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house." But the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man." So Gideon said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Please do not depart from here until I come back to you, and bring out my offering and lay it before you." And he said, "I will remain until you return." Verse 19. Then Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread and from an ephah of flour. He put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot and brought them out to him under the oak and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. After reading this passage, it's really rather remarkable that there were any doubts left in his mind. I actually understand the doubting of the fleece a bit better, because our human mind can always conjure up what-if scenarios. Well, maybe the fleece just happened to get wet. Maybe it just happened to be dry. But I can't imagine any additional doubts after witnessing an angel consuming an offering with fire. And yet, despite even those doubts, God saw fit to work with Gideon and to use him as a tool to destroy Israel's oppressors. And we, of course, recall the story, though maybe the numbers have escaped our recollection, so I'll provide a small recap. Gideon called to the fighting men of Israel, and 32,000 answered the call. We're never told the number encamped against them, but we must assume it to be much, much larger than this, perhaps numbering in the hundreds of thousands. What would the wisdom and strength of man tell us? Certainly that we would have no chance and will be doomed to attempt such a feat. But that's not the lesson God has for us. He instructs Gideon to break the standard rules of engagement. There will be no direct confrontation. In fact, the entire point of reducing the size of Gideon's army is to make very clear that they are outmatched and in every way the underdog. Judges 7:2 reads, "The Lord said to Gideon, 'The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, My own hand has delivered me.'" So first he sends 22,000 home because they're too afraid. That's probably a good thing anyway, considering how people can act foolishly when they're afraid. They might have botched the plan, made a noise, done something even more foolish. But even 10,000 were too many. So we come to the test of drinking from the stream. There's actually a surprising amount of disagreement about what really transpires here. That's outside the scope today, but I encourage you to investigate on your own. There's some disagreement about who actually is picked and who is sent home. But now the critical part is the 10,000 are whittled down to a mere 300 against hundreds of thousands of Midianites. The only way for success, barring a plague of death directly from God, is for an alternate approach to battle. And we know, of course, that they approached under cover of dark, blew trumpets and freed their torches and terrorized the overconfident army into attacking each other and fleeing in disarray, so that Israel was able to easily mop up the remnants. Note that 300 men stand against a great host, not through might of arms, not through a direct approach, not through human dominance of being better, smarter, faster. It is certainly through God's overruling. But it's also through a faith that he's working with them, and the obedience of doing what they were told, though they must have had many questions and not very many answers. The Apostle Paul's words from 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, verses 8 and 9, come to mind. Three times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Another example, similar to those mentioned before, would be the conflict between the British and the Irish Republican Army. The same book I mentioned earlier references a particular point in that conflict around 1969, 1970. The British came in as a peacekeeping force between the Catholics and Protestants and tried to use overwhelming force to rule with an iron fist. However, to quote Malcolm Gladwell, in his research he learned how little the overwhelming advantage that the British had in material resources mattered in that conflict. What really mattered were persistence and anger and weapons of the Spirit. Those are his words. I found those words particularly fitting for our theme here today. These sorts of underdog actions apply beautifully to our own situation, and I think that persistence and weapons of the Spirit are exactly the tools we need to use as children of God. When faced with the overwhelming might of the adversary, allowed to rule over this present evil world, we have to hold fast to our convictions. We can let our righteous indignation burn when we see mistreatment of our own, or when we see how this fallen world is crumbling under its own weight. When we see that this world worships crass reality celebrities, or morally bankrupt superstar athletes, we can let it serve as a reminder to us that the answers aren't now. This is a period of practicing our faith and our obedience despite distractions. I'm reminded of the way baseball players warm up before they go to bat. For those who are unfamiliar, there is this weighted ring they place around the bat that makes it heavier than usual. And they practice swinging this heavier bat so their muscles adjust to the added resistance. Later, when they remove that weight, their muscles expect the resistance and push accordingly. But with the reduced weight, the bat swings far more freely and faster. Can you imagine our current walk as being like that weighted ring? We walk through this world trying to maintain the proper character, fighting against the temptations and the weakness of the flesh, doing the right thing even when we see those around us rewarded for not doing the right thing. We have to work so hard at it right now. But when that kingdom comes, the weight will be removed and we will have had all this practice doing the right thing. It will suddenly be easy for us, and our flesh and our spirit will already be trained to the right reflexes and expectations. Just as the underdogs of this present evil world must fight overwhelming force, armed only with their anger and their weapons of the Spirit, so we too must fight against the powers of this world using what we call the weapons of the Spirit. We refer, of course, to the whole armor of God as found in Ephesians 6, 11 through 17. I won't read it in this for the sake of time, but I think we're familiar with putting on the whole armor of God. I'll skim briefly through it. Your loins girt about with truth, the breastplate of righteousness, etc. So that's, again, Ephesians 6, 11 through 17. And a discussion of the armor of God warrants an entire talk in its own right, and we won't do it justice here, but we want to highlight that these are indeed the tools of the underdog. I'll specifically read for you verse 12 and see if it doesn't make it sound exactly like we are the underdog. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And so our weapons are truth, righteousness, the gospel of peace, faith, and the word of God. And we must use them with persistence. When we're faced with a trial, do we find it easy to recognize that trial as a learning opportunity? It's generally not so easy, and certainly not our first fleshly instinct. But we can train ourselves to recognize these opportunities. At the 2015 General Convention, Brother Rick Sirossi gave an excellent discourse on the space between action and response, and how we, with training, can make sure we opt for the right response, not the automatic fleshly response. If we can recognize these trials for what they are, we can divert our energy from reacting to embracing the opportunity and growing from it. Our fleshly tendency is to become discouraged by failure, or even simply by being in a disadvantaged position. right? It's human nature it's not human nature to actually enjoy being the underdog, being expected to lose, being expected to fail. Out of curiosity, how many in here have ever played a game of chess? Okay. If you have, it's safe to say that probably half those who raise their hands, at least, have come up against somebody, or quite a few someones, who handily defeated them. Isn't that frustrating? It's one thing to be evenly matched, to win some, lose some, to feel like maybe you have a chance. But at least speaking for myself, it's that feeling of hopelessness that really riles me up. Couldn't this be likened to a witness opportunity? Have you ever tried to witness to someone who knew the scriptures better than you? Do you find that discouraging? Do you feel like you shouldn't even bother because you're no good at it? I've certainly been there. Or perhaps when you study, do you find that even though you put in a lot of time and effort, you just can't remember the scriptures as well as this brother or that sister over there? A couple of my oldest friends absolutely put me to shame with their ability to recall not only the right scripture at the right time, but even the proper citation. And yet, should this be a discouragement? Are we to be comparing ourselves to our brethren? Or is this perhaps a cause for us to celebrate the blessings and the talents of our brethren? And better still, can we use this as a carrot to pull ourselves toward greater study and greater opportunities for learning and for service? Recall that underdog we mentioned at the beginning, Gary Cohn. He was able to leverage his apparent weaknesses into a tool that helped him succeed. Can we do the same with our own weaknesses? I've seen this in the classroom numerous times. The student that has to work long hours to achieve academic success learns many other skills along the way, like how to take notes, how to study, how to ask the right questions, and even perhaps how to guess wisely. The student for whom the work comes easy learns none of these things. If I had to choose between the student that just gets it and the student who has to earn it, I would say that the latter student is the one who learns a topic more thoroughly. Similarly, who values something more, the one to whom it has been freely given or the one who had to go out and earn it? It's not that you can't appreciate what you've been given, but I think we have a natural tendency to place more value on the fruits of our own labor. And the student that has to earn it not only learns to work hard, but becomes intimately acquainted with the method. I used to have great students who could pick up a mathematical topic virtually immediately. But if I were to ask them to explain the solution to help other students in the class, they couldn't do it. That means they don't really get it. They can do it, but if you can't really explain it, you truly haven't mastered it. And I even find myself struggling with this as we homeschool our boys. I have to frequently keep Jamie involved in order to force me to explain things better, in more detail, without skipping steps. So how does this help us spiritually again? Well, if we want to truly understand a complex topic, whether it be the sin offering, covenants, chronology, would a photographic memory help? Can you imagine if every time you were asked a question, you could mentally reference the exact volume, reprint, etc.? It might sound appealing, and yet, would that mean you really had understanding? Back to the math classroom. One of the largest pitfalls students face is the temptation to blindly follow and parrot the teacher's own words. I apologize if you've heard me tell this story before, but I once was teaching a math concept, and between the students and myself, we devised three different methods for obtaining a solution up on the board. I presented one, the student said, well, wait, I did it that way. I said, oh, that's great, let's show this way, and we'll show the other way. And a student raises his hand from the back and says, well, which one should I use? I replied, he should use the one that was easiest for him or made the most sense. But he couldn't pick for himself. He said it was too confusing if I didn't pick for him. And yet, I don't know what's easiest for a student and what fits with his own understanding. And the problem with following a rule because you're told to follow it is that if you change the circumstances even slightly, what you thought of as knowledge is lost. True understanding is flexible. Parroting only works for the exact same circumstances. And so if our knowledge of the scriptures is parroting, how do we fare when we come across a thought or evidence that contradicts a particular scripture? If our foundation is inflexible, then a single deviation or question can bring it tumbling down. But if we really grasp the intricacies and interconnections, we have a much more enduring adaptable and intimate understanding. I'm going to try to go faster because I'm quickly running out of time. When you think of underdogs, does Joseph come to mind? It may not be the first aspect of the story you think of, but I can see some similarities. He didn't start off with all the advantages. He was sold into slavery. So through his disadvantages, he learned some important lessons that shaped his character. He knew what it was to be a slave. He knew about how fickle life could be. Perhaps he appreciated better the work of a slave. There are several upsides to recognizing these things. If you've been there before, do you judge someone as quickly? If you've been there before, do you show more love and appreciation for the hard work you're seeing being done? And if you've been there before, do you try to recognize the failings of others and root them out of your own behavior? Of course, Joseph also had faith in God and knew how to trust his leadings, and I'm sure it helped that he found God communicating to him through his dreams. Do we see the Lord dealing with us? It's often not as obvious. But when we do see those moments, don't we find them to be faith-building? We're faced daily with the fact that we're underdogs. We're disadvantaged by our fallen condition and constantly struggling against the adversary while being dragged down by sin. It's not at all a fair fight. So how do we turn this to our advantage? Well, if we have to work harder, we know it's going to stick. It's going to mean more because it doesn't come easily. We don't earn anything through our good works, but we do earn the good habits that we have struggled to adopt. We practice daily fighting against the flesh and adopting a loving heart attitude, even towards those that don't show us the same courtesy. And practice is important. There's another article, also by Mr. Gladwell. I don't know if you can tell, he's a favorite of mine. That claims that to master any skill, you must put in at least 10,000 hours of practice. Can we even comprehend how much time that really is? Allow me to put this in perspective for you. If you practice something for 4 hours a day, for 7 years straight, you would just top 10,000 hours of practice. If, on the other hand, you only practice an hour each day, it would require more than 27 years to master something. I wondered how accurate that 10,000 hours was, so I quizzed Sister Sarah Lightfoot from our class, who is a pianist who has a degree in that. And we believe that by this point, and she's approximately my age, she has put in probably 15,000 hours of practice. But that's what it takes to be really, really good at something. There's no room for just a bit of time. And so if we want to be really good at walking in our master's footsteps, we need to practice it every day for our entire lives, in order to be a virtuoso of the Bible. And so don't beat yourself up about your disadvantages. Embrace them as a badge of honor. It's why you were chosen to follow our Master. If I quote from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 to 29, I think you'll recognize, "For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise." Think of these poor people who currently don't have a hope for a resurrection of the kingdom. They imagine they have but one chance, and they imagine it's all up to them. That would truly be discouraging. Instead of being discouraged when we suffer setbacks and frustrations and feel like the little guy being pushed around by larger, stronger forces, that's when we need to remind ourselves not only that God is with us, but he's training us right now to possess the qualities that make us his ideal soldiers and spokespeople. There's a great quote I want to share with you. "Courage is not something you already have that makes you brave when the tough times start. Courage is what you earn when you've been through the tough times and you discover they aren't so tough after all." So remember the failings of the Davids and Gideons, and remember those failings aren't deal breakers to God. Remember the faith of David, Gideon, Joseph. Remember their hard work, even when no one was watching. Remember their patience through trying circumstances and tests of faith. And remember the rewards that came to them. How much greater a reward will we have when we're able to serve our Master in the kingdom? May the Lord add his blessing.